base your own censorship on this energy and the use of it. But creative art is very important. Music is important. Through the study of philosophy, the individual gains a great deal. He gains even more, perhaps, by spending more time with his children. Everything is important which helps him to grow, instead of merely to become richer or more powerful, or to shorten life by bringing about an impending coronary. So the 8 hours in which we should do as we please and have time is probably the great testing time of our daily existence. If there is anything that is involved in the initiations into the ancient mysteries, it was the study of time. Cronus, the great god of time, with his sickle and his hourglass. Cronus was the symbol of all devouring time, all absorbing time, and time finally drawing back into itself everything that came from it. For it is said of this, of Cronus, that all of it he ate, all of his own children, because he devoured everything that existed within the sphere of his existence. Time is terribly important to us. Time is also something in which we can grow. Time is that period in which we can take over, personally, the affairs of our own inner lives. We can think, we can share beauty, share knowledge, do all kinds of interesting things that help us to become something. Time should draw something out of us. It should not be a period which we have to fill out of any contrivance that comes along because we cannot endure our own acquaintance. Most people, the moment they have a minute of time, try to find some way to waste it. This is not the answer. Another group spend that time trying to figure out how to cheat their neighbors. That's not the right answer. The real purpose of time is to realize that this is that part of life which we pay for by education, we pay for by labor, by responsibility, by effort, in order that in that period we can be ourselves. And if we are truly ourselves, we will be rather quiet, collected people. We will also have interesting avocational interests. We will find life an inspiration. We may turn to some special field of arts or sciences. I know several persons who have become very celebrated in botany as a result of having time. Another individual had time and did other kinds of things. Sir Walter Raleigh had time while he was in the Tower of London waiting for execution, and during that time he wrote his History of the World, which is one of the greatest documents of literature. Everyone can do something with time, and that something is to use it quietly. Time moves silently with mysterious tread. It is something that we can use to become ourselves, to discover the real being that is locked in us, and in so doing, begin to appreciate ourselves. And when we realize why we are here and what we are here for, we do not become egocentric, but we do become aware of the responsibilities that we owe ourselves. That we owe ourselves in energy, or in time, and in relationships with people. Everywhere there is the temptation to make poor use of these resources. Now, in world conditions, time is becoming a great vital factor in health. There's a great deal of sickness arising today from simple fear. Fear and tension and stress. We are disturbed. We are annoyed. We are frightened. And above all other things, we seem to see hovering over us somewhere in the abstract atmosphere the constantly increasing danger of nuclear war. We are worried about pollution. We are worried about natural resources. We are trying to defend endangered species. Perhaps we don't realize it, but at the moment, man is the most endangered of all species because he is killing himself. He is poisoning the water he drinks. He is adulterating the food he eats. He is abusing the body he lives in. And he is attempting to find happiness by keeping away from all of the truth that would give him any security and peace of mind. So he is in trouble. Now, people who are more studious, more thoughtful, and are really trying, must also take this dimension of the problem into consideration. They must realize the tremendous importance of getting their minds off of things they cannot do anything about. This does not mean that you should not be aware of these things, but you are going to all have to learn ultimately to take them as you would study history. They are facts that have to be accepted. They are mistakes that are being made. There are tragedies which are likely to follow. But there also is no way or no profit for any individual to devote his life to fear and anxiety concerning things he can do nothing about. If he can do something about them, he should do it. But to simply sit back, frightened to death every day by the newscast, is of no value to himself. It is destroying his health. It is reducing his efficiency. And it is gradually corrupting him to the point where he begins to agree with all of the false rumors and beliefs and teachings that are annoying him from day to day. So we have to build a defense against this. We have to build a defense, and here we have to go back to what the world has been worrying about for a long time. It is gradually dawning on a great many people that in our great hurry to prove how great and wonderful we were, and in an effort to cultivate the tremendous progress intensity which we have come to be accustomed, we have forgotten that the one factor in our consciousness by means of which we can handle a situation of this kind is faith. This is the spiritual son. Wisdom is the son of the soul. Health is the son of the body. And faith is the son of the spirit. So the faith factor is the supreme energy factor of all. There is nothing in the universe that strengthens as much as faith or allows strength to flow through it. And there's nothing that weakens the human being or any social structure than lack of faith. And all fear arises ultimately from lack of faith. So in our problem of straightening out our energy resources, it is necessary for us to begin to put together the structure of the universe and realize that we are part of something that is forever changing. We are part of a process in which mistakes are inevitably being corrected, even though painfully. That the great stream of life is moving toward the inevitable victory. And that in a universe which is suspended from pure spirit, material things can never actually take over. The individual who tries to make them take over is buried with his ancestors. All of the great despots have gone down to a common earth. And as one poet said years ago, it is interesting to imagine that on the grave of Caesar, violets grow. And they probably grow perhaps off of the very fertilizer of Caesar. All power, all of this great pomp and panoply goes. And the thing that remains is man's motion toward the fulfillment of himself. The fulfillment of his real destiny, which is not to be bigger, stronger, and more powerful than his neighbor, but to be more and more right in the light of truth and in the facing of the problems of existence. It is actually very definite that in this problem we have a new way of building peace of mind and conserving resource. Save your energy by faith. Now, they say faith without works is not very beneficial. But faith has its own works. And where faith leads, the works follow. The works are not a substitute for faith, but they are suspended from it as from a glorious principle in space. Faith in its own way prevents us from so many false judgments. Almost all of our antagonisms in life are based upon the fact that others have injured us. Faith tells us that this is not true, that none of us can suffer from the deeds of others, but we can suffer from our own reaction to those deeds. If someone has despitefully used us, we can follow the methods of Khomeini and start a holy war. Or we can follow the advice of Christ to do good to those that despitefully use us. If we do good, we relax. There is no common penalty. To do good is to achieve good. To do anything else is to achieve that other thing. While Buddha was preaching in India, in the state where he was born, Kapilavastu, the general of the armies came to him and said, "Master, I am the defender of the state. It is my duty to protect you and all of the people of this state. And yet to do this, I may have to have war. I may sometime have to turn upon others. I must lead armies. I must take all the responsibilities for protecting the obligations I have taken. What is the answer, Master? What should I do?" Buddha said, "You should do that which is to be done. If you are the leader of the armies, then you yourself must be prepared for the karma. This karma is according to motive, according to the situation that involves, but one thing is certain. Any man who is the general of the armies must be ready to die himself in battle. He must recognize that it is his destiny. By karma, if he raises the sword, he will be struck by the sword. But if he raises the sword in the defense of principles, there is another karma that comes in also, the karma of the integrity behind his motive. This integrity will not prevent him from being killed, but in the great plan of things, it will be added to his integrities. Therefore, whatever you have dedicated yourself to do, that you must do. But remember, every dedication has a consequence. Every decision has a result or an effect. Every single attitude that we hold has an attitude dependent upon it. Every time we are angry, we are also creating inharmony. We are creating waste and loss. We have to say to ourselves, is there righteous indignation? The answer is that righteous indignation is actually perfect quietude. There is no other kind. Righteous indignation tells us that we have a right to be angry. If so, we must face the fact that others have a right to be angry at us. In nature, everything is compensated. Everything is worked out with absolute justice and mercy. Actually, we are growing, and all this dissension and fussing, all this fear and anxiety is part of man's resistance to growth. The growth comes anyway. Whatever happens, the growth will be the ultimate reward. When we cooperate with growth, we grow with it. When we oppose it and fight it, we build a karma of opposition and fighting within ourselves. So our energy resources tells us that if our faith is great enough, in order to maintain inner peace, that we can then face all change with a good hope. We can face all the situations of life without anxiety, without fear. We can do what is necessary with perfect calmness of spirit. This is only possible, however, if we add maybe something else to it. Faith is a wonderful thing. In fact, it is absolutely necessary. But how does one develop faith? It's a little difficult for the average person to say, I can totally accept the situation that I do not understand. How can I have faith when I see nothing but misery around me and the wrong people always seem to be winning? How can I have faith when it looks as though the future is clouded with a darkness beyond our comprehension? So Plato came to the answer to that particular question very simply. He said, in order to have faith, you have to use the mind. You have to use the reasoning power to protect faith rather than to tear it down. In other words, you use the rational power to prove that the true is true, and not in a desperate effort to prove that the untrue is true. The purpose of reason is to become aware by study, by thought, of the great rules, laws, and principles that sustain life. This is philosophy. And philosophy is the handmaiden of faith. And as Plato himself said, the only end of learning is that it shall sustain and justify faith. But faith has to be justified for most people. They have to understand something of the world, something of life, something of the powers and pressures going on. They have to become aware of the grand scheme of things. They have to become more conscious of the great integrities by which all things exist. Science can give faith because it can give certainties. It can give such evidences of the realities of universal laws that it's almost impossible to doubt them. But we also have to have that kind of justification, that philosophical justification, that enables us to take something like a universal law, which is applicable to physics or astronomy or biology, and put it into our own psychological integration. We have to find in our own way, through wisdom, through learning, through study, the grand scheme of things. Now, where will we look for it? All through the world, from the beginning of time, there have been persons curiously endowed who seemingly have a closer comprehension of values than other persons. In the rather confusing vacation that I just went into and out of, we went down to Sedona in Arizona, and I kind of revived my contact with a lot of the Indian life there and found something very interesting. Since I had been there many years ago, an entirely new group of young Indians have come up. And these young Indians have gone back in their own records. They've gone back to the ancient legends of their ancestors. And they've taken those legends and thought about them instead of laughing at them, instead of thinking how stupid their ancestors were or why it would be impossible for a primitive Indian sitting on the top of a mesa to make a major contribution to knowledge. They began looking into these things to find out what the old ones were believing. And the old ones were dying off pretty fast. Not many of them left. And some of these old ones did not want to die until they had left the story of what they knew to somebody. They had been more or less sworn to secrecy. But now they wanted somebody to know. So they shared this knowledge not only with their own younger people, but with an occasional Anglo, being a term for non-Indian. This peculiar circumstance has led to some interesting discoveries. Among the Hopis, for example, the question came up of what came first? What was the first thing? Now, these people can't read or write. They've never been to school. Their knowledge comes only from the old ones who went before them. So they asked one of these old men, what was the very first? And he said the very first was space, going on forever, an infinite area. On and on and on and on. Everything, everywhere, all over, full of space. And what happened then? All life came from space. All life came when seeds were sowed in space. And who sowed the seeds? God. And who guided this? God. And how was it all handled later? God picked wise men, taught them, and gave them the leadership, and told them to instruct the people. And step after step you went along until you did not know whether you were in Hopi Land, India, China, Japan, or Greece. The same teaching. The same principles. The same realizations. The same beliefs. The same integrities. The same requirement of initiation into the tribal rites in order to prove merit and worth. In many tribal peoples, a young person is not a citizen by birth. This idea of citizenship by birth wasn't known much by the ancients because it didn't fit. And why didn't it fit? Because nobody can be right by accident. No one can be wise by birth. No one can be proved to be a good citizen simply because he was born. So when the time came to decide about who should be a citizen, the young person, man or woman, was initiated into the tribe. They had citizenship bestowed upon them. The milk name was taken away from them, and they were given a grown-up name. And from that time on, they weren't children anymore. And as grown-ups, what were they expected to do? The answer was simple. Dedicate their lives to the good of their people. What were they to do for themselves? Only that which they could do without injuring anyone else. What were their duties to the family? When they went hunting, the first game should be brought to the widows and the fatherless. What did they do for exchange? They had no money, no currency, whatever. There was no profit in the system. When one of them had an argument with another, what did they do? They dug a hole, and they told the two of them to talk their argument into the hole. Then they said, fill up the hole and shake hands. And that ruled America for hundreds of years before a white man got here. We know the answers to these things. We know what's wrong. But we're just not very interested. But if we are not more interested, they're going to get more and more wrong. And the more wrong they get, the more tired we are going to get. And we won't have money enough to pay the doctor's bills. We will not have sufficient energy to learn anymore. So we will try to forget. We will try to ignore everything and slip into the grave as painlessly as possible. Even the Indian knew it wouldn't do any good, simply because he knew perfectly well in his own heart and mind that when he slipped into the grave, he was still there. He was still alive. He still knew right and wrong. He still had to face his own deeds. And in most American Indian communities, he was going to be reborn back and live it out. They believed that. So that the Indians gradually have revealed a lot of interesting things to us. The healing methods by which we are to overcome most of the diseases are based entirely upon a very complicated religious ceremony. And in this religious ceremony, before it is over, the cure is due to the fact that the individual restores his faith in the plan. He becomes aware that help comes from space too. He realizes that it has to be earned. We have no right to be healthy unless we deserve it. And in the great Yabichai and the medicine ceremonies and so forth, The person has his consciousness of social citizenship restored. While he is on the sand painting, he is one with the universal life of things. He shares again in the great laws of his people. He calls upon the great spirits of the people. He makes new obligations to himself. He rededicates his life to useful purposes. And while the chanting goes on, the drums roll, and the rattles are rattled, he gradually regains his citizenship in his own tribe, something that was taken away from him in many instances where foreigners coming in would not let him even have his own language. But when he became again well-adjusted member of his own society, living in the laws of his own society, living in the mesas and in the cliffs, living in the deserts upon the simple fare that he gained there, sharing with those of his tribe and kind the lot of life. When he began to understand these things, he got well. He became a well-adjusted citizen of his own people, and in so doing, fulfilled his destiny. He could not have done it without faith in the old ones, the Manitous, the great teachers who had gone before, the Sky Lodge. All these things had to be in his consciousness, or he couldn't do it. If we don't want today to gain security under the pressures of present conditions, we need a strong and abiding faith. A faith has been given to us, and we've got to keep it. Our religion, which has been gravely neglected, is the most powerful instrument for our salvation that there is, not just theologically speaking, but in terms of putting back into this world a social order in which it is possible for the individual to live according to his own inner convictions. The spirit power of the first son in us is true, right, rejoicing in righteousness. When we live according to the divine plan, we will live. When we break it, we will die. When we keep the rules, they will keep us forever. But unless we have an understanding of something bigger than ourselves, something more worthwhile than the little accumulations to which we are dedicated, unless we have a purpose nationally, internationally, racially, culturally, a purpose to build something that is going to endure, built upon dedication, self-sacrifice if necessary, martyrdom if need be, but build toward an eternal pattern of securities. Unless we are willing to know that we are here to do something, we won't do anything. And not doing anything important, we do all kinds of things to hurt each other and ourselves. But if we once gain an insight into the plan of things and realize that we were created to help to fulfill that plan, that we were intended to roll up our sleeves and be part of this great program of righteousness, when we understand that, we can do something about it. And if we can't do very much about it because of conditions around us, then we have to know that by virtue of conditions within us, that no one who tries can fail, that no one who makes a good effort can escape the reward for that effort. We are eternal. We have been here before. We'll be here again. It goes on and on. The virtues that are not rewarded now will in due time be rewarded. But the vices which we think we have evaded, they will be back also. We will have the perfect right to recognize that out of a great cycle of embodiments, we have one lifetime. A lifetime that goes from the cosmic cradle to the cosmic grave. The lifetime in which we are all growing up. And in this lifetime, it is very necessary that we learn the rules so that we can use our energies, use our strength, use our powers, and use our skills to advance a common end. The reward for this is peace. The reward for this is a civilization that can endure. And it also, in a more personal way, rewards us with better family conditions, better community life, and better health. Because the dedications to common good help digestion and do all the various remedies a great service. For a remedy may be partly effective because of its own virtues, but it is more effective if it is used to accomplish a real and sovereign good. The whole problem of energy, therefore, is to use it right, use it skillfully, use it honorably, make sure that it is not wasted, because it's just as true of energy as anything else when Ben Franklin said, "Waste not, want not." We are wasting every day our resources, our time, our energies on things that are not important. And for that reason, the important things are going to the dogs in front of us. So we have to try, each person, try in your daily living, try in balancing your budget, try in shopping, to be thoughtful, quiet, conscientious, and honorable, and deal as far as possible only with others of the same kind. But always remember never to fret, never to fuss, never to get all excited and unhappy and perturbed and annoyed. All that is just plain waste of time. And he who wastes time wastes himself and wastes the eternity of which he is a part. I think it's very good to think of the idea that is beginning to come back to us from the past, namely, that this civilization, this pattern of things, had a keynote. It had a destiny. A civilization that rises is a great center for the diffusion of energy. The American people have been known for centuries for the tremendous resourcefulness of energy. The dedications that were made by our early founding fathers were enormous. The labor of building this nation, day by day, year by year, of building it together, of creating an organized place which was to become a refuge for millions of persons in distress and sorrow in all parts of the world. This nation had a reason for existence. That reason has slowly faded away from the average member of society. He no longer thinks of it anymore. He is no longer aware of the fact that his country is a dedication, that there is some reason why he should rebuild or restore the original purpose. For out of the corruption of other countries, we sought to build a clean country. We cannot allow the corruption of that country to cause it to join the corruptions of the ages that have faded away. We are now in danger of doing the very thing that we created this nation to prevent, avoid, and escape. We have changed aristocracies, but we still have them. We have complete lack of dedication to the great good for which we were intended. Now, it may be that some of us still feel that way. We have that dedication. And more will have it every day, because it's coming back and coming back very fast. But with this dedication, we will use our energies day by day in what ways we can to be of more use, more value, more friendliness with other people. And in so doing, we will build a destiny. And sometime, somewhere, all those who labored together to make it a better world will have that better world. And little by little, the corruptions that have failed to achieve anything will fade out. We have to start. Religion gives us faith. Wisdom strengthens our religion. Labor glorifies both faith and wisdom. And also, all of these together provide the proper, normal use for energy. And we are more or less reminded of the Eucharist, which is probably one of the most sacred symbols of Christianity. "This is my blood," said Christ, "which has been sacrificed for you. This blood is life. Christ becomes a symbol of the spiritual sun. The rays of that sun are the blood of life. And in ancient times, the sun was shown with drops of blood pouring from it. In early Christianity, the Lamb of God was shown with the seven wounds. And there were the seven wounds in the breast of the Mother of Mercies. The blood of life is energy. The right use of energy is the most important dedication that there is. There can be no religion apart from the recognition that the life upon which we live is sacred. The energy that makes that life is a responsibility, and that everything that happens all the way along, we are living in the midst of sacred matters which we cannot profane without inevitable tragedy. It is absolutely necessary for us to look upon the universe as the body of a divine being, and every cell and every atom of that universe must be treated with respect, treated with, if necessary, with veneration. And every energy, every utility, every element, every substance that we have should be used prayerfully and used sincerely and with the greatest sense of obligation, because all these things are part of the body of the divine power in which we live. And those that misuse this power are abusing life and abusing the great principles which were given to us to make our own way happier and better. So let us remember that energy is the blood of the sun shed for us, and that it is our responsibility to use that energy for the common good of each other. Well, I guess I better quit now. No, thank you, sir.